dilemma is one of the problems that this guy faces and everybody else who is feeling some of these population pressures. Everybody wants to live out here, or not here, I mean, we're in Tennessee. Everybody wants to come to the West and have that big open space, and then they find out that, my gosh, there's a feedlot down the road, and once in a while the wind blows in the wrong direction and it stinks. They're on this easement. One of the prohibited uses is no buildings anywhere in the hash marks. Can never build a building again anywhere on that easement. Now, that's why there is what we call this building envelope, which is the solid area. And on that, you can replace or improve. You can, if the easement says so, if the documents say so, you can add a house, add two houses. You can, again, going back to my original statement, you can kind of create your own universe. If you contemplate that on the building envelope part of your conservation easement, that you're going to have a couple of grandchildren that might want to move that back to the ranch and build houses someday, you can specify on that building envelope that houses can be built there, but not on... Yes, sir?
But that would subtract acreage from your easement when you do that.
It does.
Lower the value of your easement.
It does lower
the
value.
Actually in the easement, that's what I'm saying.
I'm sorry.
It can be either way. It can be a reservation of right on part of the easement property, or you can have it as an island outside of your easement
land. Which will probably raise the value of that land if you do.
Now, obviously, in this community, one of the clauses in the easement that prohibited use is there will be forevermore no more subdivision of this property. But what they're giving up is the development rights. Now, even though I said earlier this is in the floodplain, in this valley there are so many pressures for development that the development rights associated with this property are actually worth almost as much as the conservation easement itself. And so a part of the funding component for this transaction was a sale of the development rights to some developers by the rancher from this property. And they were able to trade those development rights and take them somewhere else in this valley. No further road construction. So whatever roads exist on this property are the roads that will exist forevermore. Now, you can improve the roads as necessary. Culvert gets blown out in a flood, you can replace the culvert. The bridge breaks, 25 years from now because cattle have been moving across the bridge. You can replace the bridge, things like that. Yes, sir?
Again, I think I emphasize the specificity of that easement. Because I've got an ag easement.
Yes.
I can build my houses, but I can build structures anywhere I want to, barns, hay sheds. Yes. I have to have approval, but they can't refuse that.
Okay.
And I can build new roads anywhere that help me for my ag purposes. If my conditions change, I want to subdivide pastures and run cattle in another direction, I can put culverts across the stream and put new roads, and I'm just restricted on impervious surfaces.
What I'm trying to give you here, and I appreciate the feedback on other specific properties, is that these are some typical clauses that you might see in a conservation easement document. And let me go back to my original statement. You can create your own universe. It's up to you, the grantee, and as long as you satisfy the requirements in the IRS code, the certain requirements that are necessary, and that document satisfies that, you're okay. So, typical, as I said.
I'll mention one more thing.
Go ahead.
My deal hinged on, they came down and they said, well, you can't have, dumps and waste things, blah, 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 blah. And I said, okay, fine. Any rancher that tells you, a farmer, that he's not going to have a dump is either alive or going to go out of business. So let's get it straight right now. I'm going to have dumps, and I'm going to burn, and I'm going to throw away everything I can burn. They won't. I can't recycle barbed wire. Mm-hmm. I can't give it away. I've got to do something with it. So you also, what I found is that the easement, the land trusts, you know, are technically, you know, populated by people not like us. All right, they are typically sort of on the other side of the fence. So you got to push. You got to push for all you can get, and you'll find that they will frequently cave under the understanding that they don't get a land trust.
Absolutely right. Mm-hmm.
Well, and another thing too, this is an educational effort, and you know, if there becomes a point in time where you are at a roadblock stage, and you invite the people of the land trust onto your ranch and say, this is how I have to operate this. If you want me to keep this as a ranch and not as a subdivision, here's some of the things I'm going to have to do. And you know, that kind of dialogue, I think, kind of loosens things up. A couple other things. For instance, there's no recreation allowed on this easement. So the notion that we're going to have an open space golf course is completely out of the picture for this particular easement.
It probably would be for all.
I mean, the whole purpose of this, and the reason you get organizations interested in, is to keep the condoization and golf courseization of the West to a minimum. Let me just quickly say some permitted uses that you might see are, and this goes kind of to the lady's question about, is this a commercial enterprise because I'm doing agricultural practices? Especially if there's a conservation plan and you've devised one with the NRCS, let's say, and you're fulfilling the purposes of that conservation plan, normal conservation practices would be allowed. So if there's a necessity to put in to stop a head cut from occurring on a property, put some ditch meandering devices in, build some gabions, that kind of thing, build some weirs, those are normal conservation practices associated with good resource conservation and protection. So, and it's part of a normal agricultural operation. That could be written into an easement. Let's see, one other good one this particular easement, there's no recreation allowed on it, but there is a clause allowing the lease of part of the easement to a duck and goose hunting club. So, and the income, of course, from that is beneficial to the rancher. So even says no recreation, like golf courses, there's this sportsman recreation component built into this conservation easement. So those are the kinds of typical things you would see in a given conservation easement that are necessary to comply with the IRS requirements. So on to you.
You know, I just have to note how interesting this has been, because the first one of these I did back in Charlotte, North Carolina, with Lynn Cornwell. You know, we were a little concerned about getting out of the room alive, and now there's actually people who've done conservation easements in the room, so it's just the change in 10 years is pretty
Lynn
amazing.
Lynn has that problem. And has nothing to do with you.
I was hoping they wouldn't find out. But, you know, I think the one thing that we can't stress enough, and this gentleman has really alluded to it and really nailed it, is that, you know, you don't even want to think about this until you have interviewed every single organization that might have an interest or might be able to hold an easement where you are, to make sure that you're philosophically aligned with them, that they're going to have the kind of oversight that you're going to be able to live with, that you know exactly what their intentions are, and you get that out right away, because this is a contract and you can negotiate a contract. And most organizations, just like, you know, any kind of, you know, contractual negotiations, they're going to get hard-lined, and And, you know, you just have to be really firm about what you can and can't live with. And that's why I think, you know, if you're fortunate enough to have a land trust in your area that has sensitivity to agricultural needs, that's definitely the way you want to go, because those people understand that you have to make a living off this piece of property. And at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. I don't care what they offer you or what you get, what kind of tax returns you get, it, none of it is going to matter if you have this egregious restrictive document on your property where you can't even do anything. Yes, ma'am.
What happens if the trust that you're working with for some reason goes out of business or does something so that it doesn't exist anymore and you've given away your easement to this trust? Can they sell it? Can they give it? Can they change it in any way?
Did you all hear that? Okay, and that's a great question because, again, you know, we're trying to get through all this information in a short period of time, but that's one of the IRS requirements in a conservation easement, is that if that very thing, the land trust or whoever you're working with, you know, goes out of business or goes defunct, what's going to happen to your easement? And so you have to have a provision in there that it can be transferred. Can they sell your development rights? Absolutely not. Once you restrict those development rights, they are gone for good, and the organization that holds that easement is responsible to the IRS for making sure that those development rights are never exercised. So, but that's not to say that you lose oversight of where that easement might end up, because it has to go somewhere. So my suggestion and what, you know, we have done is you decide who you think an acceptable backup holder would be, and you name them in the easement. And if you can't find one, then you put language in there that said they must understand the business of agriculture, they have to have similar purpose, similar philosophy. And if there's no one named and that organization goes defunct, then a like-minded organization has to get that, and the closest district judge and the land trust and the landowner all will agree on where that easement goes.
Over the other side of the coin.
If I could add one thing, that was a big sticking point for us.
Yeah.
Because I could just envision that California would end up in North Carolina, which meant PETA would be the next ones in line. And so the only way that my attorney, and my first one, who was a very good attorney, my best friend, we had almost negotiated until one of his colleagues became available to specialize in conservation easements. We started all of them completely. Yeah. So I can't overemphasize getting an attorney that really understands conservation easements as opposed to just a good attorney.
Yeah.
Don't let that good attorney.
No, because you don't want to pay for their education.
Let him tell you who is a good conservation.
Yeah.
Anyway, what we specified, the attorney said, look, let's just, since they wouldn't budge, I even offered the name six organizations and they wouldn't budge. But they did let me prohibit it going to a governmental agency. I said, it's over.
And we put that.
It's going to go to a governmental agency. So then we kept it to the charitable organization. And then he just said, let's be specific enough in the purpose.
Right.
So we included raising livestock for all the other things, including human consumption.
Let me address other side of this coin. I'll read you a clause from this easement. In addition, the inability to carry on any or all of the permitted uses in this easement or the unprofitability of doing so shall not impair the validity of this conservation easement. What does that mean? If the ranch goes out of business, if they can't no longer function as a viable entity, it doesn't impair or terminate the perpetuity of this easement. So that's another thing to think about.
And also a couple things that the IRS is going to look for that, I don't know, you know, different parts of the country, the issues are so different, and so I don't know how relevant it is to this part of the world, but I can tell you that in certain parts of the West, it's a big deal, and that's mineral. So one of the things that the IRS says is that there can't be any surface disturbance of that land. And that means gravel pits, that means, you know, open coal mines, those kind of things. Now, that doesn't talk about oil and gas exploration, you know, if it's done by drilling and with minimal surface disturbance. So if you have those kind of values on your property, you need to think really strongly about what's going to gain you more benefit. And if you want to continue those activities, you need to think about, you know, also working with the land trust or the organization and finding the language that you find mutually agreeable, because especially in the West where there's a lot of incidents of split estates, if somebody wants to donate a conservation easement and they don't hold all the mineral rights, then you have to find somebody, a certified geologist, that will go out and prepare a mineral report that says those outstanding mineral rights are, there's so little chance of them being exercised as to be not even, you know, worth raising an eyebrow over, because the IRS is very serious about surface disturbance, other than if you have a gravel pit on your property and you use it for your own purposes and your own roads. Usually the organization will say that's okay. But if you have a gravel pit that's making you a lot of money, you should just carve that out of the easement and not even think about putting it in there, because it's not going to fit in with the conservation purposes, and the IRS will get hung up on that. Yes, sir?
Some of our land that we're looking at proposing, it has oil shale. There is oil. Mm-hmm. We have found oil, not a large production amount. But I just said this explosive thing. They do have means of drilling and putting off a charge, which basically drives the oil, allows the oil to come out of the shale more readily. So you need to put, you had a chance of that being oil shale, like in New Mexico, San Pedro, Moscow Ranch, but they do have oil shale there.
Yeah, well, it's a big deal in Colorado and Wyoming and New Mexico right now. So those are just things that, you know, we could spend 2 hours talking about that issue alone, but they're, you know, things that you need to be aware of. Yes, sir?
If I investigate a land trust and I like them and our purposes are mutual, we do a deal, go down the road, 10, 15 years from now, the land trust is taken over by junior league ladies. And they come up to my farm and say something like, do you castrate animals on this farm or something? I mean, clearly, our purposes have diverged. Can I go get it out of there and put it in another land trust?
Could you all hear him? What if years down the road, somebody else takes over the land trust interest and it becomes a different kind of organization, and they're questioning, you know, the, your activities on that ranch? And so that's one thing that I think you need to be aware of, is that, you know, what if their philosophical purposes change and they change their mission and yet they still hold their easement? Number one, that's why it's so critical, because people come and go and there's no institutional memories, but what's in that document lives forever. And so whatever you're allowed in that document, I don't care what they tell you, if you have the right to negotiate or conduct those agricultural purposes on your property, they can, you know, they can be obnoxious, but they can't do anything. So you want to make sure that the language in your easement allows you those types of things. Now, if you really truly come at odds with that organization and you don't want them to hold your easement anymore, you can go before a court and ask that easement to be transferred. And again, it has to be, but the land trust, the landowner, and the district court have to agree on it. And so, you know, I'm guessing that, you know, if the land trust is confrontational, you might have to take it to court. Or if they don't really want to have anything to do with you, they're probably going to agree to have that easement transferred. But it's got to go somewhere.
Putting language in the beginning, does it help with that?
Absolutely.
Sure.
It does. That, you're absolutely right.
I mean, that's for a similar contract.
Yeah.
That's what it says. 10 acres more or less, or 10 acres. And you can take it from there.
And that's why it's just so important. Whatever you put in that easement is what you are, both you and the land trust, are obligated toward. And that's why you shouldn't rush through it. So I'm just going to talk really quickly about the difference between purchased and donated easements, and then allow, because we're kind of going over on time, allow Mr. Thomas the, because he's got a lot of really important information for you as well. But, you know, as you brought up, there's a world of difference between purchased and donated conservation easements. And not everybody in this country is fortunate enough to live in states where there is statewide funding. There are some, and then there aren't some. But the typical kinds of funding that you may be able to find anywhere in the United States is if you do have some source of statewide funding. California and Colorado are extremely lucky that we do have statewide sources of funding. They're heavily competed for and they're hard to get to, but at least we have them. Sometimes there are local purchase of development right programs that counties may have passed on a county-to-county or regional basis that you might want to inquire about. And again, those probably aren't going to be in areas where there isn't a lot of resort or development activity, which is usually why those PDR programs are passed. But you might want to look to the Farm Bill programs, and that's an especially important topic right now as we're moving into the 2007 Farm Bill. Programs like the Farm and Ranchland Protection Program and the Grasslands Reserve Program were designed within that program, and in part by the industry to provide benefits for landowners. And so you may want to ask your, and those programs are overseen by your Natural Resource Conservation Service. So you should go to your local NRCS guys and ask them if they have any of those kinds of programs available. Also, you know, there are the other conservation programs like a Wetlands Reserve Program, EQIP, WIP, some of those that, you know, are shorter term in nature. So definitely check with your NRCS to see if there's any kind of funding available locally. You might also check with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife to see if they have sort of any kind of programs available, or your state Department of Wildlife, however that's configured. Now, the one thing I will tell you, that if you are lucky enough to get funding, and you are indeed fortunate if you do, with money comes strings. If you're getting money for an easement, they're not giving it to you because they're just really wonderful, generous people. They're expecting something in return. And so we always sit down with our landowners and say, look, this is the kind of language that you're probably going to be expected to sign off on before we even waste our time and effort going after this funding. Is this something you can live with? Because some landowners go, no sweat, and other ones say, over my dead body. And so that definitely is a reality that you need to keep in mind, because they're going to ask for sometimes, especially when you're dealing with government agencies, some pretty major things. Now, there's quite a bit of money available for endangered species. And if you can get to be part of the Safe Harbor program, that's the way I would go. But again, you know, you have to decide whether you get the kind of security out of that you think you and your family needs in terms of what you need to manage your property. So I can't stress that enough. And also, what you're probably going to expect to see if you're being paid for an easement is they're going to want a management plan. And the one thing that I would advise you, and if you have any negotiation power at all, you know, you may say it's okay to have a management plan, but don't let them include it in the conservation easement. It can be referred to outside of the easement, but it shouldn't. It's just so scary to have management, you know, intensive management practices included in a perpetual document, because you're going to forever have to live with that. And again, none of us know what that landscape is going to be like 50 years from now. And if you're the last place in Dodge where the, you know, lily-livered periwinkle lives, and, you know, and it exists, and it finally goes out of existence because there wasn't a big enough area to support it, don't let it be on your dime and your fault because it went out of existence because you happened to be the best habitat it had, and, you know, and the best chance it had. So, you know, that's one thing that you really seriously want to think about. And I would also tell you one last thing, that, you know, there are two reasons to do a conservation easement that I can think of. And, you know, there's a lot of sub-reasons, but number one is because what is most important to you in the whole wide world is to preserve that piece of property for whatever reasons and whatever land ethic you have. That's the first reason. The second reason is because you've sat down and run the numbers and talked to your professional advisors, and it makes economic sense for you and your family to do it. And one shouldn't be exclusive of the other. And that's my final parting advice to you, and then we'll hand it over to Bill Thomas here.
Thank you. How's the time doing?